I have personally been involved with the Prestige Seminar Series for a good number of years and was very pleased to be presented with the Friend of Easter Award at this event last year. Therefore, I'm also very happy to see that James Hannah will receive the award this year. In common with many of the previous Prestige Seminars, the event this evening, Cold and Dark by 2050, has particular synergy with activities at this university. In particular, the latest university buildings and estates development focused on the new student residences at our College Lane campus, that's about 1 kilometre from here, which incorporates a new eco-friendly energy centre to power the residences through renewable energy sources. The centre aims to be a true carbon zero solution, to be classified as BREEAM, just for the uninitiated, Buildings Research Establishment Environmental Assessment Methodology, outstanding. This combined heat and power solution, which relates to the demand reduction talk this evening, will use sustainable wood chips as a fuel source, producing mainly water vapour emissions and reducing the carbon produced by 2,500 tonnes every year, and incidentally also saving over £500,000 of energy per annum being used from the national grid. Also, our research and development activities in the Research Centre for Engineering Research encompasses projects in the area of sustainable energy technologies, which in fact relate to the supply options talk this evening. For example, we provide research input into the production of novel vertical axis wind turbines, which are suitable to be installed on the top of buildings. This research activity has also led to the development of more efficient wind turbine blades. In addition, another research team has produced a new polymer electrolyte membrane, that's a PEM in the jargon, fuel cell stack that has improved both volumetric and gravimetric power density in comparison with more traditional counterparts. So you will understand that I am most interested in the three talks we will be hearing this evening, as they each focus on an important aspect of the cold and dark issue, including the final talk dealing with the interrelationship between supply and demand. Finally, as a reminder to the engineering colleagues in the audience, this seminar invites certification for the continual professional development, which can be signed by any member of the Easter Committee. It is an exciting programme, and therefore, without further delay, I will now pass you back on to our chair, Malcolm Grimston, who's coming behind me, who will deal with the Arkwright Scholarship. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John, and thank you for the great honour of being asked to chair your event this evening. It's kind of got a bit of a Cambridge Imperial feel about it, as you'll pick up both from the speakers, from my own personal career, and from one particularly welcome guest, because we start off, of course, with one very pleasurable part of the evening before getting on to the other very pleasurable part of the evening. I was always told to be as diplomatic as possible in these moments, which is, of course, the presentation of the awards. The first of them, the Easter Innovation Award. I think we're constantly told that our brightest and best, in England in particular perhaps, tend not to go into science, technology, engineering and maths. I have to say, from the quality of individuals I see at Imperial, I'm not at all sure that that's the case. But Easter, for a very long time, has developed a programme of scholars, and every year awards the Innovation Award to a particularly worthy individual. I mentioned a very welcome guest because last year's winner of the award, Theo Georgiou, is with us. Theo? Just to show how prestigious this is, since he did this, Theo has clocked up 5 A stars and an A at A level, which I think in itself is worth a round of applause. But more important, he is applying to do engineering, and he's applying to Imperial and to Cambridge. So what more could you want? Oh, gosh, you've got it's either a Cambridge or an Imperial man there. However, the torch gets passed, of course. We have a new candidate or a new winner this year. I'm told I had a chat with the winner's mum. What she most remembers is buying a brand new sofa, wonderful thing, and our winner tonight using it as a whiteboard. His mum is here with him today, presumably because she didn't let him out of her sight. But the winner is Owen Pearce from St Albans School. Owen is doing his, in his final years at the moment, he's doing his maths, further maths and physics A-levels, has been running the school's junior STEM club, Science, Technology, Engineering and Maths Club, for some time, which encourages youngsters to get involved in engineering design. And he's been to the engineering Head Start course at Liverpool. He's applying to Oxford, but you can't have everything in life. And four other Russell Group universities. So, Owen, if you'd like to come up and accept the award. So it's a cheque for £150, and of course this wonderful memento of the achievement, and we have a photograph to be taken.
I know from the courses I have attended and the people I've met at school and university visits that there are a lot of very clever and hardworking people interested in engineering, and so I do feel especially grateful for the support and encouragement this gives me. As was said, I am in my final year at St Albans School studying maths, further maths and physics, and I hope this time next year I will have started a mechanical engineering degree at university. I'm very excited about the university offers I have received so far and about the prospect of further study. Although I have always enjoyed maths and physics, and particularly the way maths can be used to solve problems, attending courses run by the Small Peace Trust, Arkwright, and Head Start has given me a great opportunity to explore different aspects of engineering. In fact, one of the courses I went on recently that I really enjoyed was about the challenges of producing sustainable energy, so it'll be very interesting for me to hear the talk tonight. To talk about my aspirations in engineering, I must first briefly talk about my past. Watching Formula One on television and go-karting at the equivalent level of Sunday League when I was seven were two important parts of my childhood. Luckily for my mum's bank account, it would only be 5 years before I realised that the target of being a racing driver probably wasn't the most realistic. But less fortunately for her, it would be another 3 years before I would stop racing. However, it was in this period of time that my fascination with engineering began to grow, which would lead me not only to deepen my understanding of race car design, but through the courses that I've attended, also begin to explore wider fields of engineering. Knowing this, it probably won't come as too much of a surprise that the big project I'm working on at the moment is building a kit car with my granddad and dad. It is certainly a case of slow and steady wins the race, but it has been an extremely fun way to spend my summer holidays and weekends, although perhaps quite not as fun as seeing the look on my parents' faces when they realised that they might find me as an 18-year-old on the road in a 700-kilogram car with 400 horsepower. For those of you who live nearby, don't worry, I'm also producing front and rear wings for the car to try and help it keep pointing in roughly the right direction. At this point, I really must acknowledge my Arkwright scholarship, which has provided me with the funds needed for some of the books and CAD software that I've needed to procure in order to have a decent shot at making these wings, which I've decided should produce about 30% of the car's weight in downforce. Ahead of university, I was tempted to study aeronautical or automotive engineering, but university visits have helped me to decide to study mechanical engineering before specialising. I've alluded to my career plans already, but in case there was any doubt, I very much intend to work as an engineer in Formula One, but in what capacity will be decided in the next 5 years or so. To conclude, thank you all very much indeed for this award, and for all the help and suggestions I've received so far tonight, and for a very interesting and entertaining evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Owen, and congratulations again. The second award is to the friend of Easter. Now, at this point, I was going to build up the tension, so I'd keep you guessing till the last moment. Our esteemed Vice-Chancellor rather put the spoke in that by announcing the winner beforehand, but we shall continue. James Hannah has been in Easter since April 2009 as a representative of the Institute of Civils, Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire Branch Committee. Been a member, hard-working member of the seminar working group in the course of that, and it says here his greatest achievement was masterminding the successful 2011 seminar engineering the Olympics. Presumably a bit in there about drug testing, that sort of thing. I don't know. Anyway, his friends, who all know him as Jim, were very saddened when he retired earlier this year. He's been missed. He's known for his sense of humour. He's also known for his... doesn't actually say pedantic here, but reading between the words, that seems to be the suggestion in terms of comments to keep the minutes as accurate as possible. And it says he single-handedly stuffed our delegate wallets. Presumably that's some sort of engineering euphemism for something that particularly want to go into. But it says nobody's ever done that before or since, which is probably to be something to be grateful for. But to acknowledge his contribution, Easter is therefore delighted to ask James Hannah to become a friend of Easter. Here's the, you don't get £150, unfortunately.
No. Sure.
It's a shame. Not right, is it? Perhaps we'll do that one later, we'll split it with you. Okay,
thank you. Well, what can I say? I'm not going to make a speech, but I've quite enjoyed the stuffing and the nitpicking of the minutes. But I'm really delighted to receive this award. I enjoyed my time with the committee. Such a friendly bunch. It really was great to work with them. Apart from all the serious stuff, we had a few laughs. And I'm always good for a laugh. Anyway, no more to say, really. Just to say thank you very much indeed. It really is appreciated. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jim, and congratulations again. So that brings us on to the second main business of the night, which is, of course, the seminar itself, Coal and Dark by 2050, How Sustainable is Our Energy Consumption? I guess, in a sense, that might look a rather depressing title, but I don't think it is, because it could very easily have been Cold and Dark by the 20th of November, which is rather more in line with the latest National Grid projections, or indeed Boiling and too Hot to Survive by 2030, which is in line with some of the more pessimistic climate change projections. It seems to me, I've had great fun this last year. I've been writing a book on it's going to be called The Paralysis in Energy Decision Making, just born of a frustration. I've been in the energy business, focusing mainly on nuclear since the mid-80s, and just an enormous frustration at how difficult it is to take any sort of decision about anything in the energy field at all these days. To take nuclear as an example, many of you will know that the first understanding of nuclear fission as a scientific concept was in 1938. The first demonstration of it as a kind of macro phenomenon was in 1942, Fermi's famous squash court experiment in Chicago. 2.5 years later, there was a deliverable atomic weapon in July 45, and then, of course, the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs the following month. The first electricity from nuclear fission for flickering light bulbs in the States in 1951, followed by the first nuclear submarine reactor in 53, the first electricity to be generated into a grid at Obninsk in 1954, and the first commercial-scale nuclear power station in 1956. So within 20 years of a new scientific phenomenon being identified in a test tube, we had an entirely new source of energy. In January 2008, Gordon Brown, and the younger ones of you probably need to tell you, he used to be Prime Minister of the country, but that's two governments ago, in the foreword to the nuclear white paper of January 2008, said that now more than ever, we needed new nuclear power in the United Kingdom. It looks just about possible that 8 years later, early next year, we might get an investment decision towards a single nuclear plant, twin reactors at Hinkley Point. Whether or not you support the concept of nuclear, it is very difficult to imagine that we are on the right track when it takes those sorts of periods of time now to get practically nowhere. The public inquiry into the Wilver A station, you may know that Wilver on the Isle of Anglesey in the north of Wales is in line for one of the new nuclear stations, and indeed might be the second or third site if the programme goes ahead. The public inquiry into Wilver A took 5 days. It took 5 days because on the final day they had to look at the hundreds of miles of electricity cables, otherwise they'd have got through it rather more quickly. The Sizewell B inquiry took nearly 2 years to take evidence and another 2 years to report in the mid-80s, and now we're in the position that we actually are. And yet, we really can't hang around any longer. We're in a very peculiar position. If we just look at security of supply, even leaving climate change to one side, that on the one hand, last December, we, in our role as electricity consumers, shelled out £1 billion in capacity payments to existing power suppliers so they wouldn't shut down their existing capacity earlier than otherwise they might. There was a small amount of that money was supposed to go to new build, to a new 1,800 megawatt gas-fired station in Trafford in Greater Manchester. We've heard in the last couple of weeks that that project almost certainly is not going to go ahead. Then we have the National Grid having in the course of the last week, to exercise its new powers to require large electricity consumers to be ready to be switched off, possibly at a few minutes' notice, because we are now so tight, our capacity margin, as it's called, that spare amount of reliable electricity capacity that is needed if demand is higher than we expect, if there's a particular cold snap, while at the same time a number of our existing plants should happen to break down or be unavailable for other reasons. I don't think the lights are going to go out this winter, but while we are consistently not building anything by way of new dispatchable, reliable capacity, then that margin is going to shrink and shrink. We're going to be less and less robust against those unlikely events, and the time will certainly come when we catch it. So, having to pay out £1 billion to persuade people to keep existing plant going, while we are getting desperately short of capacity. And the third part of this extraordinary story is, of course, that this year we've just seen a general election where everybody was arguing that the price of electricity is too high, that we're being ripped off by the electricity companies, and we've got to find some way of cutting their income. Now, it doesn't take an economic genius or any sort of genius to work out that something is not working particularly well in a market. If you can't, even at existing prices, persuade people to make the sort of investments that are necessary. Peter Atherton, when he was at the Citigroup, did some quite interesting calculations on the amount of investment which is required. Depends on the scenario you look, but by around the year 2030, we have to invest somewhere between 6 and 8 times the total amount that we invested in the 1990s in the Dash for Gas, if we're going to safeguard our electricity security of supply just up to 2030, forget 2050. And in his view, there is absolutely no chance whatsoever of anything much more than half of that amount of money actually coming in, given the market-based system that we have in electricity at the moment. Now, we can look back and see some of the reasons for this. One of the reasons, you may recall, just around the turn of the millennium, was a period when we did have a lot of spare capacity in electricity. We had built a lot of gas stations during the 90s. Regulatory action broke up the generators into very small units. There was cutthroat competition, and the wholesale price of electricity, in effect, fell to below the short-run marginal cost of a lot of the units on the system. And we kind of got used to the idea that that is what electricity costs. But if you don't do anything to update your system, and we've hardly done anything to update our system over the course of the last 15 years, then we start to hit cliff edges. We've got the Large Plant Directive, which is going to take most of our coal-fired capacity offline. And in fact, that's pretty much dealt, because it didn't. That even if, say, the United Kingdom voted to come out of the European Union at some point, then even so, those coal plants have not been maintained because people knew they were going to close. The newest coal plant on the system is Drax, the bits of Drax that are still coal-fired, commissioned in 1974. So there's not much we can do about that. The nuclear plants, the vast bulk of the second generation, Wilver A comes to the end of its life, the last of the Magnoxes, next month. But we should be seeing most of the, almost certainly will be seeing most of the second generation, the advanced gas-cooled reactors, coming offline in the middle years of next decade. Now, when you take the bulk of our coal and our nuclear capacity out of the system, that's well over half of our total capacity. I'm sure there'll be different views on this, but my own view is I find it difficult to see how all of that capacity can be replaced by variable capacity where we're depending on weather conditions for that output. This is starting to look a crisis of the absolute first order. As I say, that's not saying a word about climate change and the need that we have to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. If you look at the record since the Kyoto and Rio base year of 1990, in the Rio Convention conference in 1992, 1990 was the year that we decided we couldn't afford to, that we had to freeze carbon dioxide emissions at that particular level. Carbon dioxide emissions are now somewhere over 65% higher than they were in the year 1990. There has only been a single successful policy in the course of the 25 years since that base year, which has reduced carbon dioxide, and that was the subprime crisis in the United States, which was, I don't think it was designed for that purpose, but the economic recession caused by irresponsible borrowing gave us the only year when carbon dioxide emissions came down. Everything else we've tried in terms of energy efficiency, in terms of renewables, has got us precisely nowhere in terms of that particular fight. So I thought I'd just warm the audience up for our speakers with these few cheery thoughts. I'm not going to introduce our speakers. You have their CVs or brief CVs in your pack. And indeed, I'm going to say we've got Peter Guthrie, Director of Centre for Sustainable Development at Cambridge. We have the Chief Scientific Advisor at DEC, John Lofhead, and we have Professor Stribich, who's at Imperial, at my current alma mater, Chair of Electrical Energy Systems. I'm going to invite each of them to give their presentations in course without me interrupting in between them, unless, of course, they run over time, in which case they will find I interrupt. But I'm fascinated to hear what we now have to say, and then, of course, it'll be over to you for any comments or questions you'd like to make. So, Peter, if I can hand the stage over to you.